5-4-3. My name is Ed Goldberg. I have the great pleasure to be speaking to Gregory McDonald. Welcome to KBOO, Mr. McDonald.
I am pleased to be on KBOO with you, Mr. Goldberg. And, good morning to all the good citizens of Portland and the environs and all the ships at sea.
Yeah, we got to talk about Grover Whalen, too. That was a very Grover Whalen thing to say. So,
was it really?
Yes. The title of your latest book is Flynn's World. And if people, I suppose, would know you best from the Fletch books, eh?
I suppose, yeah.
Yeah. How many of those did you write?
There are 9 Fletch books.
9 Fletch books. Yep. We were talking briefly before we started recording here. There were 2 Fletch films. I didn't even know about the second one, and I'm supposed to be a movie guy. But let me ask first. Were you happy with the translation of your books to the screen?
You know, when I was out on the set for making Fletch, the day that I arrived, I got a phone call from the wonderful director, Michael Ritchie. He was really a great guy and a great director, at least regarding this film. And his head was in the right place, and so was his heart. And he called me and he said, you know, I really want to take you out tonight for a drink because I got something to tell you. Something to say to you. So I said, okay. So he took me to Morton's, and we had a drink. And I said, okay, what is it, Michael? And he said, no, you haven't had enough to drink. Have another drink. So I had a second drink, and I said, okay, what is it, Michael? He said, no, you haven't. Yes, I have. And I said, what have you got to say? And he said, you know, when you're writing a book, you're writing for a 105-piece symphony orchestra. He said, when I'm directing a film, I'm directing a piccolo. He said, you know, I just want to tell you that because you'll never be satisfied as author with any film ever made from your book. And, of course, the real Fletch aficionados, those who love the books, didn't like either film.
Mm. Was Chevy Chase a good choice?
Yeah. You know, there were 10 years between the book's appearance and the film. And the reason for that was that everybody, every actor in this world, from the age of 7 to 70, wanted to play Fletch. Believe it or not, including Mick Jagger.
Mick Jagger wanted to be Fletch.
People
in Hell Want Ice Water. I mean,
he spent a lot of money and so forth trying to attract me to get him to
apparently
play
the phrase wildly inappropriate is not in his vocabulary. I suppose his life indicates that.
Well, he was the sexiest man I ever saw in my life.
Is that true?
Yes, really.
Uh-huh. I've really seen the Stones live. I understood his appeal, but it didn't transmit to me. But
and I love his work, but, you know, an American boy, he ain't.
Mm-hmm. No, he ain't.
So when Chevy came along, Chevy is very bright. And Chevy was known for, you know, Saturday Night Live and he had done a few other films, but he really hadn't been the star of them. And he had no international reputation, and Fletch and I did. So he thought that, you know, that doing Fletch would make him an international superstar, which it about did. And he was very bright, and he dug what I was trying to do. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I think it was fine. And, you know, the first Fletch movie is a classic. It really is. And then the second Fletch movie, Fletch Lives, they didn't go back to the original material, which was a big mistake. And it's okay, I guess.
Mm.
But it's not a...
It's kind of you to say that, actually.
it's not the classic the first one was.
Right. Well, let's talk about your current book, Flynn's World. Now, Flynn, how many Flynn books so far?
This is the fourth.
It seems almost the way you're still finding the character, though. There's maybe I'm wrong about that because clearly this is the first one I've read. But he's a cop.
He is a person who had been in espionage, and things got dangerous for him, and he was sort of hidden out. He was embedded in the Boston Police Department as sort of a cover.
He has an NN number. Is that like a 00 number?
Exactly. The organization for which he was working was called No Name,
mm-hmm.
Because they, as he says, worked between the borders. So he and his family spent a year in Ireland, and then they, because No Name wanted to bring him back and be able to use him sometimes, he's the only inspector of Boston Police, and he brings all this other experience to police work, but he's not a cop. You know, he doesn't understand the protocol. He's not ever even sure of the laws. And he's a man of such compassion and understanding. And he's seen so much that the people call him Reluctant Flynn, because sometimes he understands the the perpetrator so well, he doesn't think really that they should face, you know.
This is a drawback for a policeman.
Legal justice.
That's right. Right. Maybe we can take him out for a drink and pat him on the head and convince him of the right path in life.
Yeah, sort of that way.
There's a very funny, it's almost a throwaway here about a case that he involves himself in with a judge that he knows where I don't want to give too much away because it's a great little set piece joke, but he runs afoul of the guy who's been accused of the defendant by giving his testimony when in fact it's exculpatory. Mm-hmm. So yeah, mm-hmm. I maybe I've already said too much. I don't know.
No.
Okay. He also has a family which, if it's not the ideal Father Knows Best family, the only difference between this family and Father Knows Best is his kids are way too smart and glib for the Father Knows Best. Yeah. All of his kids sound like James Joyce when they talk. What's up with that?
Well, they're bright kids.
And
they've had the experience, and he is, you see, he was, working in espionage when he was like 14 years old, his parents having been murdered. And he therefore expects his kids to be as sharp and clever as he was. And he uses them sometimes in his cases, and they're wonderful. The relationship between Flynn and his daughter Jenny is a strong pull in the book.
It starts out with her problem. She has a problem. It's not her problem per se, but I don't know. Do you want to talk about what happens if there's a kid in a graveyard with?
Yeah, Jenny wakes him up in his middle of the night, and when he's exhausted, and requires him to go to the graveyard, the boneyard, and where her boyfriend, she's 13, he's 15, where her boyfriend is standing patiently, his ear nailed to a tree.
Therein hangs the tale.
You know, how and why.
Yes.
You know, how and why. And, of course, you know, the whole book is about, our daily cultural clashes. And where on earth did this idea come from? And you know, how did this happen? And why did it happen? And who did it?
And why won't the kid say anything about who did it?
Exactly. Why won't the kid say anything about who did it? And it's you know, a bit of a cultural throwback, which we run into every day and so forth. Ed, this book, it's amazing. It's getting 5-star reviews all over the country. I mean, people are really digging it. Especially do I appreciate Jack Bush's review here in Portland. I mean, that's just great. I'm so happy.
Mm-hmm. Well, you should be. Any good review is a wonderful thing. There's if you're an appreciator of snappy dialogue, witty dialogue, this whole book, I despaired at the beginning that it was going to be nothing but witty dialogue all the way through, and there would in fact be no plot, you know. Mm-hmm. But eventually the plot ensues, you know.
Yeah.
But there is an awful lot of snappy patter in this thing. Do you generally think in snappy patter? Is that do you build a book around that, or is there actually a story?
There are two answers to that question. First of all, you know, I don't terribly care much about plot.
Good for you.
And stories. what I like to do is to take people and put them together, and then I get out of the way and I let them interact. And the electricity, the energy among the people is what makes the story, which makes the wit, which makes the theme of the book, and so forth. And, some people, you know, you read, most books, and you're listening to the author all the time. And I'd rather have I want to just point the finger and get out so that there's no Gregory MacDonald between the reader and the characters. And the second thing is that, you know, it's my trick is to think of the obvious line, you know, the line that works as everybody thinks of, and then go, you know, that's okay, but let's go below that, let's go below that, let's go below that, let's go below that to find the right line.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know about you, Ed, but you're a movie maven, and I sit there at, you know, in the average picture, and I am rewriting the last line, every line I hear.
Well, that's things about...
You know, you could do better than that.
One of the things about Katharine Hepburn's death that has reminded us of the way dialogue in films used to be.
Yeah, before what do they call it? Well, all these special effects. FXX, what do they call it? SFX.
EFX.
EFX, thank you.
Yeah.
You know. Now a film is kaboom. Forgive me for saying that.
Well, no, there were small films too, and even at that, you know, the films that make an attempt to be something like, you know, the art house films, the little independent films. While there's sometimes awfully good writing in the films, the Pat and Mike dialogue, the Bogey and Bacall dialogue, yeah, it's just not there anymore. And I'm wondering if it's because people's attention span is gone, or if it's because people simply can't write that way anymore.
Well, you know, in the good old days, well, first of all, they had one camera and three walls, and they didn't have kaboom and flashes and bangs and so forth. And what mattered was the character and the dialogue. Now you can sit through a picture that cost $80 million to make, and there's no character, and there's no dialogue. It's kaboom, kaboom. And again, in the good old days, you know, you'd have a script, and before they started shooting it, they would give it to somebody who was called a script doctor, and he would take the dialogue, which was, you know, utilitarian, and he would change the line to mean the same thing, would be a little bit more clever, a little bit wittier, a little funnier, or a little bit more touching, and it was mm-hmm. valuable function. And
that's true. There's a guy named Abe Burrows who
yes,
yeah, Abe Burrows came from Jewish vaudeville up through Broadway, and when they brought him out to Hollywood, he would put funny lines and
exactly
into otherwise
right.
flat dialogue.
Exactly,
there were
right.
some guys like the Epstein brothers who wrote witty dialogue right from the get-go, but didn't have much in the way of character development. So for them, you had to bring in the character guy to develop the romance a little more, or
right.
you know, to thicken the plot a little more. But they had the witty patter down
right.
cold.
That's right. I mean, you know, there are movies now. There was a movie out last year which was they thought was going to be a huge blockbuster. They had 17 writers.
Anytime okay. you see 17 writers in a film, you know it's a mess.
Exactly. And, you know, they lost the sense of sequence, and there was no, you know, dialogue. There was, you know, and there was supposed to be a love affair in the middle of this thing, and it didn't work at all because the sequence was off and you didn't understand it, and there was no anything to it, and the thing was a bust.
In fact, one of the things, talking about this book, Flynn's World, again, let me remind people, I'm speaking with Gregory MacDonald, the author of Flynn's World, published by Pantheon Books. One of the things about this book is that I found it deeply conservative in a liberal humanist way, if that's the best way to describe it.
And, you know, in the last week, I think I've been called a conservative, a liberal, and a libertarian.
Yeah.
They've called me everything but a poltergeist.
Okay, you're a poltergeist.
Thank you, you did it.
Well, here's the thing. This is a book that has respect for respect, I guess that's the best way to put it. Decency between people, good manners, an education, family tradition. And none of it's in a kind of a schmaltzy Pat Robertson do it this way or go to hell thing.
Right.
You're creating a sense that this is something that's lost from the American scene, that we no longer care about each other on a day-to-day basis, that even everyday manners are out the window. Is that a fair description?
I think that's a very fair description. You know, I explicitly state have stated in the book that, you know, there's never been of people who have thrown away their culture as rapidly as we have in the last generation or two.
Yeah, the tissue paper culture.
We've just thrown away our culture.
Yeah.
You know, it's alarming because, you know, the theme of the book is, let me put it right up front here.
Well, we need to talk about Louis Loveson, I suppose.
Huh?
We need to talk about Louis Loveson, don't we?
Yeah.
Yeah. Reaching into his socks for his glasses. Now that's unprecedented.
The theme of the book is if chaos is to be avoided, probably it is necessary to assume that we are coming from somewhere and to presume that we are going somewhere. You know, the idea is that, you know, there have to be navigators in this world. There have to be people who, you know, look at the squall, the temporary storm, and those temporary doldrums, and say, okay, the purpose is, you know, to get there, and we can't get there unless we understand where we came from, where we are. And I think we sort of lost that sense. Don't you agree?
Well,
within this spring, we saw, you know, the American policy change completely politically, you know, the preemptive strike. I mean, that is, you know, okay, It happened once, or twice or more times, too many times under the Monroe Doctrine in Latin America. But this business that's been happening this spring is a whole change of American policy. And do the people in the government understand that this is a whole new change?
They don't understand anything.
In government policy. No, I guess we're in a little trouble there.
They're reactive. They're not proactive. They're not intelligent. They're not anything but... Oh, hey, you know, this is going off into a tangent maybe that we don't want to go into, but...
Why don't you tell me what you really think?
You don't want to know what I really think. Let's talk about Louis Loveson. Louis Loveson is a superannuated professor at Harvard. Yep. He's a respected old man, sort of. There's a lot of the young Turks in the faculty who don't think he's much. Mm-hmm. And his classes, which used to be stuffed with people, now rattle around with in a big lecture hall with six or seven students in it. And his problem is that he still thinks that dead white guys have something to say.
Yeah, well, the thing is that he believes in the principle of logos, that we are coming from somewhere and going somewhere. And he is accused of elitism and the dead white male gig, when in fact he is saying, you're totally wrong. I have been completely inclusive in the idea of logos, and that's why he spent so much time in Egypt and the Middle East and so forth, that he's brought everything into his philosophy. He's excluding nobody. And then he goes to a reception, cocktail party or whatever it is, at a dean's house, and here you have the current university faculty, and the women are standing in one place, the blacks are standing in another place, the Asians are standing in another place, the younger professors are standing in one place, and the older professors are standing in another place. And there is no integration at all going on. Quite the contrary. They're politically opposed to each other and fighting each other and so forth, and he just doesn't understand it. They reject him, and he doesn't understand why, and he's sort of rejecting them, saying, some of you were my students. Didn't you learn anything? That we are all in the car together, and that we've got to move forward together. And
well, it's worse than that, because he's been getting vaguely threatening notes, and not so vaguely threatening notes, and a website which has really ugly stuff about him.
Yeah.
And he doesn't even have a computer, so he doesn't know from websites.
Right. The internet can be, I'm using it as a great poison pen. You can put things on the internet which are totally irresponsible and poisonous anonymously, essentially, and it's something that is happening.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's a subplot in this that I found interesting, and that's the internal politics of the Boston Police Department. Mm-hmm. It's a small subplot, but it's one that I found amusing, because they have created this post of inspector. There was no post of inspector before Flynn showed up in Boston. Mm-hmm. And he is the only inspector in the police force, and he has no duties as assigned. Mm. There's no job description for it, and it's created a lot of resentment in the ranks, not the least of which for his factotum and driver, a cop named Richard Whalen, whom he calls Grover, and nobody gets the joke. I mean, does nobody remember who Grover Whalen was anymore?
Do you know that I read a review of one of the books in a French newspaper, and it actually had a footnote.
Excellent.
Which said, Mr. McDonald gets Grover from an American cartoon.
Oh, that's so wrong.
And, I read this and said, what the heck are they talking about? What American television cartoon? I didn't know.
Grover Whalen was the official greeter of the city of New York for, I don't know, how many years? 50 years? Was it that
Probably
long?
Yes.
I can't remember whether he started in the Jimmy Walker administration or the LaGuardia administration, but it was like back
Get
in...
me dead.
Yeah, I don't know. I do remember when he died. He died in the 60s, and he was still performing that function into his 80s, not, the way he did. Because it's one thing to meet the Queen of England when she comes in on the Queen Mary at the dock. Mm-hmm. It's another thing to meet a plane load of rock stars from England and give them the same courtesy and treatment. He was the official greeter. And I think he was probably, a dollar a year man? He probably didn't get much money for his job.
Well, lots of perks. Yeah.
Yeah, lots of perks. That's right. He did get to have dinner with the Queen of England and all that stuff. But people knew Grover well, and like you knew the name of the Vice President of the United States, more so, in fact, because any time a world personage came into New York, Grover Whalen was there in his cutaway and morning coat, shaking hands with them.
Right.
And this, he just calls, and people think, well, maybe it means gopher. He's just demeaning the guy. Yeah. Nobody's got any education anymore. Is that a sly way of saying that nobody's got any education anymore?
Well, more to the point is that, you know, with his background and with his brightness, Flynn leads a very internal life as well, and he's forever muttering and saying things that nobody in the world understands, except the reader.
Yes.
I think the reader, you know, gets a kick out of it.
I think so, too. Whalen, it turns out, to have probably more compassion than he really needs. He takes to Professor Loveson in a really, really big way and decides that the pearls falling from the great man's mouth are things that he needs to have heard in his life and has never heard before.
Right. You know, my daddy used to say, and he didn't, I don't think this is original with him, I don't remember whom he was quoting, but he used to say that the perfect education is two people sitting on either end of a log with a book between them. And, you know, I think it's almost time for Henry VIII to come along, as Henry VIII purged the monasteries and cut swaths through our universities and cut out the deadwood for which parents are paying unmercifully, and get them back to the job of educating. You know, get rid of all these, you know, if you want to be in research, and there should be a research institute, but, you know, when you have universities who are, you know, people are getting enormous grants to write profound papers on why some people comb their hair with the part to the right and why some to the left. I mean, you know, and parents are having to pay $30,000 a year to get their kids through school. This is, you know, get back to education, get back to
frankly, teaching. I have less problem with that than I have with the trade school aspect of university, where university as a job preparatory school,
exactly.
To turn you into a drone for the machine.
Exactly. Well, you know, as long as you mention that, the purpose and the point of the Ivy League always was to give you a great basic Renaissance education.
A liberal arts education.
You know, at Harvard, you cannot do pre-med. You cannot do pre-law. You have to get the whole thing. And then after you get your education, then you can specialize. But listen to this. I'm quoting from the book. We're talking about Louis Loveson. He believes that what he calls civilization cannot continue without at least some people having a solid grounding in the historical, cultural, political, and scientific foundations of what he calls our society. In 1914, 82% of colleges required a math course. 86% required science. By 1993, the percentages had fallen to 12 and 34%. In 1914, 76% of the colleges required a philosophy course. By 1993, only 4%. Okay? Now, you know, you talk about, you know, the scandals, the high percentage of cheating that's going on everywhere, from the doctors, the lawyers, even the professors in our society. You bring this into Enron, the way you run a corporation, and all the polluters and so forth and so forth. They don't have a grounding in the humanities, in you know, the simple idea that we're all in the car together. And therefore, they can do what they want, and to hell with the employees, to hell with the customers, to hell with the world, because they don't have this basic idea of the social contract that, you know, pro bono publico, that you have to behave in a certain way to make, you know, society continue there. You have to be fair. You have to have some interest at heart other than whether you can afford to buy a $93 million estate in Florida. You know, this is really what we're talking about here, that we're losing our center, our grounding, and this is sort of, but you know, I'm talking too seriously here. This is a witty, funny book. I mean,
it's a witty, funny book, but you know, it makes good points. And because something is said in jest, doesn't mean that it's not a serious and weighty issue. In fact, it's the spoonful of sugar that helps the medicine go down. Not that this is a hard to swallow thing.
I know that song. Why don't you sing a verse of it?
No, I don't. I don't know. You want to? Go ahead.
I haven't heard
Knock
that
yourself out.
For a long time.
Do you have to be achieve curmudgeonhood to start believing this stuff? I wish that more people understood that they're getting a debased coin. That, you know, it's like the Gresham's law. Is it Gresham's law of coinage, where if you have a debased currency, everybody starts taking the gold and silver and putting it in their mattress? The same thing is happening now with culture, where we're getting a kind of a debased coin of culture, and the good stuff has gone into hiding.
You know what I think, Ed? I think the instant popularity of this book is, to me, it's like, hey, I'm writing about something that everybody knows and everybody feels and everybody wants to say, and I'm just making it explicit. You know, I really think that we understand this, and nobody's been saying it. And I think that's why everybody's standing up and throwing their hats in the air over this book, because here I'm saying something that is accurate, true, and you know, nobody's saying it, but you know it, I know it, and we feel it and believe in it. And
well, here's a question. Did you have an agenda when you started this book, or did it just emerge as you were writing it?
No, I didn't have an agenda. I don't have agendas. And, of course, when I was thinking about this book, and, you know, first of all, let me say that, you know, the mystery novel is the greatest vehicle of social criticism.
Absolutely.
In the world, because it is pedestrian. Okay, it's about people. It's about the street. It's about the sidewalk. It's about where the telephones work or don't. No, there was no agenda there, but what scared me and made me hesitate was that, you know, I was going to preach, which I'm not, and, you know, that it would be didactic, which I'm assured it is not. Flynn is not, you know, committed to any point of view. He is just a receptor of a variety of points of view. And
but it's also quite clear where his sympathies lie. He makes known by subtle gesture and sometimes small comment that he's on the side of the angels, or at least as he perceives it to be.
Well, you know, I don't know too much about your background and where you came from and all that, but Flynn's background is very wide, and he's been through a lot of things in the world, and he is terrified of one thing, and that is chaos, you know. I had a teacher once who used to say that, you know, that civilization has a skin as thin as you can believe, and you rupture that skin, you know, by a crime, by doing something, and all of civilization can fall apart. I mean, we saw that last century, didn't we?
Mm-hmm. 20th century was a vile century.
It was a vile century. You know, chaos is what is terrifying to him. It's not that necessarily that he believes in something. It's that he doesn't believe in nothing. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Nothing is terrifying. Nihilism is terrifying.
William Gibson was here once. I was talking to him about one of his books, and he said back in the 60s we believed that everything bourgeois was bad, and for the last 35 years we've been bleeding bourgeois at the seams, and now we need it more than ever.
Very good.
Yeah, I like that line a lot. We have to wrap this up, but it was wonderful talking to you. I've been speaking with Gregory MacDonald. He's the author of Flynn's World, and plus all the Fletch books, and is a witty writer. The book is published by Pantheon. Mr. MacDonald, I hope you come back to KBOO again.
Hey, thank you very much. And Portland is a gorgeous city.
It really is, isn't it?
This is the first time I've been here, and I just was brought in town last night, and it's gorgeous. This is a wonderful place to be. You're very lucky to live here.
Thank you. We think so, too. Come again.
Thank you.